What happened to Miami's Eiffel Tower and may happen to Wynwood? What makes Hialeah a healthcare fraud mecca? And Kenyan cops are in Haiti, so what will they do? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at the ugly collapse of what was supposed to be a marquee Miami attraction and a potentially ugly threat to an actual Miami showcase, Wynwood. We'll ask, does urban planning stand a chance in Miami? After a Hialeah councilwoman is indicted and suspended, we'll also ask why that city is home to so much healthcare fraud. And we'll examine how a multinational security support mission will help rescue gang-ravaged Haiti now that it's finally there. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. We're going to start the program today with two new snapshots of Miami's chronic urban planning failures and frustrations. A decade ago, Miami voters approved a downtown waterfront development called Skyrise, billed as the city's very own Eiffel Tower. It featured a more than 1,000-foot-tall structure that would attract millions of visitors and hundreds of millions of visitors' dollars. 10 years later, all you'll find on the site today, as WLRN reported last week, is a wasteland, a dumping ground. At the same time, we're learning, as the Miami Herald reported this week, that even in pockets where we have shown urban planning sense, forces inevitably undermine it. Exhibit A is Wynwood, the city's uber-hip art and dining magnet, home to our globally famous Wynwood Walls. There, a new state law threatens to usher in the rampant high-rise development that's been so controversial in areas of the city like Brickell and Edgewater. It all makes you wonder if sane development in Miami is just cursed. What are your thoughts about Miami's urban planning dysfunction? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio here is WLRN investigative reporter Danny Rivero, who revealed the rubble where Miami's Eiffel Tower was supposed to be standing, and Andres Villucci, urban affairs reporter for our news partner, the Miami Herald, who showed us what could be happening soon in Wynwood. Gentlemen, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Danny, let me start with you since the idea for this so-called Miami Eiffel Tower is a decade old. Let's listen to the original developer pitch that you unearthed for your WLRN report.
Skyrise Miami, a landmark project for a world-class city. Miami's Eiffel Tower.
Miami's Eiffel Tower just makes you want to grab a croissant and a cafe au lait, doesn't it, Danny? So tell us what and where this epic project was supposed to be.
So if you don't remember it as the Eiffel Tower of the South, you might remember it as a giant paperclip, or some people said it looked like a shoehorn. It definitely did. You know, it was a super ambitious project. It was supposed to be privately funded. More than $400 million was to go into the construction. Private funding, I'll say. You know, there was all sorts of plans for it. They were going to have bungee jumping off the side, observation deck, rock climbing on the top with a, you know, a 40-mile view of the entire region.
Yeah.
You know, it was very...
supposed to be one of the highest structures, what, in the country, no?
Right. It would be one of the highest structures in North America.
And remind us exactly where there on the waterfront, in Bayfront, it was supposed to be?
That's the thing about this.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a piece of land. You can build the tower anywhere. It was prime real estate in the city of Miami. Waterfront, kind of sitting behind Bayside Marketplace.
Yeah.
On down to, you know, in this little sliver of land, about 2 acres, in between the downtown Miami. So with a view of the skyline, but also right next to Port Miami. I mean, prime real estate.
Yeah,
that's where it was supposed to go.
Definitely. But Miami residents approved the idea enthusiastically, right?
You know, Miami residents did. About 70% of voters approved it because it was publicly owned waterfront land. In order to lease it out or to sublease it, they needed to go to a vote. There was a pitch, and it said it was going to be privately built on the public land. People approved it. The city executed the lease. The developer, Jeff Berkowitz, he spent, you know, a long amount of time trying to get the private funding for it. And, you know, one of the things, the early roadblocks was just a few months after voters approved it, the Berkowitz went to the county and said, hey, can I have public funding to help with this? And then you had some people say, hold on, the ballot said private funded.
Yeah.
And it created this whole, you know, battle in the courts and whatnot. And ultimately, the private funding, the public funding was killed.
But was part of the attraction of this was that they would be bringing something to that waterfront area that would be sort of civically more serious than just Bubba Gump shrimp and Hooters.
That was kind of the pitch. And then the county, the former mayor Jimenez, he supported it because he said, look, the county already put hundreds of millions towards the Adrian R. Center not far from there, the Frost Museum, the public art museum.
Yeah.
You know, like it made sense to do something like that. Ultimately, sure. what came is that the public funding was killed because that's not what voters approved.
Right.
The private funding didn't come through. COVID came, drove the costs up and everything. Berkowitz in 2021 said, this project, I'm not going to have the money for it. And then I went there.
Right.
And it's
and you visited
it's a
the,
disaster.
You visited the site, and so did former Miami Mayor Tomas Regalado, who had also backed the project. Tell us what you and he saw there.
Well, he went separately, right?
Yeah,
I talked to him and he said, oh my God, I went to Bayside with my grandkids and then I walked by and there was... I mean, it's trash. There's literally trash everywhere.
Oh, we saw your pictures.
And there's weeds that are no longer weeds. Some of them are about as tall as I am. There's huge mountains of debris, of construction debris and rubble. It's like gravel. I was there when it rained. There was a huge lake in the middle. Trucks were... driving through. I should mention too,
communities like Liberty City are affected by the collapse of this scheme.
I mean, that is part of the, you know, why I was looking at it, because with development projects like this, especially ones that have public support, there's typically strings attached to it,
uh-huh.
you know, and some of the strings attached to it were, you know, this is going to benefit the inner city of Miami, the poor neighborhoods of Miami, because the city's going to get, increased lease on it. And there's also going to be annual fees that they're going to pay into this Liberty City Trust, which does like affordable housing and whatnot.
Yeah.
You know, and so I looked at it 10 years later and said, well, is this money coming in? Like, what's happening? And then, no, the money stopped coming in 2019. And the city said, well, that's so because it was conditioned on the tower being completed. But
so
then what happens now is the lease is still in effect, but the money is not required to come in.
So there are other residual effects. Yeah. So, Danny, I want to come back to this in a moment, but I want to turn to Andres Villucci now and what he warned us could happen in Wynwood, just north of downtown Miami. First, Andres, I want to remind our listeners what I mentioned at the outset, that it seems Wynwood actually did its urban planning due diligence. It had a reasonable strategy in place. No? Can you briefly tell us about that?
It did, and it's one of those unusual cases where developers and property owners tried to do, quote-unquote, the right thing for once. It was about 10 years ago, about when Mr. Berkowitz was launching his tower.
Uh-huh.
The owners of properties in Wynwood got together. They formed something called Business Improvement District, which is a quasi-city agency, and proceeded to make a plan. Why? There was no residential in Wynwood, and I'm talking about the industrial zone of Wynwood, the old warehouses. That's what everybody thinks of when they think of Wynwood, the graffiti, et cetera.
Walls to paint graffiti.
There was no residential there.
Mm-hmm.
And the thought was, well, to make this a real thriving neighborhood, we need people living here, as well as coming on the weekends to party and look at art and whatever. So they made a very rational plan, won an award to 2 years of negotiations among the various property owners in the city. And the plan was, we will allow buildings only up to 12 stories on the major streets. They have to have a certain mix of uses, and they have to have certain art elements, graffiti, art at the ground level, to reproduce the feeling of Wynwood, of the hip Wynwood.
Yeah.
But you know, the joke was that this would be Wynwood 2.0 because it was an improved Wynwood. There would be people on the streets. And it's, as we can now see, it's actually bearing fruit.
Right. Yeah, but now comes a new state law known as the Live Local Act, which is supposed to be an affordable housing engine for Florida. But critics say it's just another red carpet for reckless high-rise development. Can you remind folks what Live Local is and does?
Sure. And I think here you have a kind of collision of two well-intended plans with unintended consequences. Live Local was passed by the legislature last year. Basically, it's supposed to be the magical solution to the very serious affordable housing crisis in the state and, and in South Florida. And the way it does that, and here's where the trouble comes in, it completely preempts local controls in commercial and industrial districts on height and density. Basically means that now a developer could come in and the local authorities have no choice but to approve projects that are supersized. That means they can be, you know, 5-10 times as large as anything around it, and the local municipal officials can do absolutely nothing to scale it back.
Right. And so under the auspices of Live Local, Andres, you found the developers are already circling Wynwood with projects like a 48-story residential tower that would in all likelihood turn an already dense Miami district into a 24/7 traffic jam.
That's correct. And remember, again, the planning that has been done, the infrastructure that's being built, anticipated buildings of 5 to 12 stories. Now suddenly comes a developer with a 48-story tower. We're talking Brickell, downtown Miami, Edgewater kind of density.
Yeah.
Completely unprepared for, completely unplanned for. And the city tells me they have at least five other Live Local applications right now for that industrial district of Wynwood. Now, remember, the intention here is to bring affordable housing. These developers have to promise to set aside 40% of the apartments that they build under certain definitions of income-restricted housing is a technical term. It can get pretty buggy. But basically, it's broadly known as affordable. But when you look at the numbers, you're really wondering.
We're going to see. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking to WLRN's Danny Rivero and the Miami Herald's Andres Vellucci about Miami's chronic urban planning dysfunction. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Danny, going back to the Eiffel Tower of Miami, tell us where things stand now with this grandiose project on the downtown waterfront.
Right. So where things stand now, the tower is not going to be built. It's just not going to be built. The lease is still in effect, and it's like a really complicated contractual thing that the city has with because technically the land is being leased to Bayside Marketplace and it was being subleased to build the tower. Whatever. The big story where it is now is that the lease is still open and valid. It's a 99-year lease with Bayside. And then the company that owns Bayside, called the Ashkenazi Acquisition Corporation, which is out of New York, I asked them, like, what's the plan for that site, that very precious waterfront site? And they said, you know, Bayside's having major renovations, and then they're going to very soon start what they told me is cosmetic improvements for that lot where I found all the trash and whatnot. Yeah. And you know, they said that they were expecting to. They told me they filed permits. I couldn't quite confirm that, but they say that they're going to work on it and they want to do a separate project there at some point, which will probably have to come back to voters. I don't know what it'll be, but they still want to do something there.
Andres, in the bigger picture here about when we're talking about urban planning dysfunction in Miami, along these lines, I wanted to ask you about a journalist and an author named T.D. Allman, who died last month and who wrote what a lot of people consider a seminal look at Miami and these kinds of issues we deal with here in Miami. It was called Miami City of the Future. What's still relevant about T.D. Allman's take on the city in that book four decades later?
It's amazingly relevant. He came in the mid-80s when everybody had written Miami off. Miami was dead. Paradise Lost, if you remember the Time magazine cover.
Cocaine Cowboys,
and he predicted that no, actually, Miami has the conditions to become a leading city in the country. And in fact, the rest of the country will follow it. And those elements were immigration, trade, but, you know, all the warts as well, the crime, the violence, the pursuit of pleasure above, you know, productivity, the pursuit of happiness, if you will. And he really hit it spot on. And so many years later, we see really the culmination of all these trends that he identified way back in the 80s.
But were these trends, these ingredients you're talking about, were they just seeds then for the kind of urban planning chaos? Or was he seeing these elements as something more promising than that?
It was a mixed bag, but he, on the most part, he saw promise. And he did see the development in the new edition published a few years ago. There's a new foreword where he addresses that whole issue of the growth. And in fact, he was here just before he passed away, had not been here since the pandemic, and was amazed at these towers. But he said it's a logical conclusion of those trends that he saw 40 years ago.
Right. And again, the name of the book is Miami, City of the Future. Was published, what,
1987 or thereabouts was the first edition.
Okay. No, I really look forward to checking that out myself. Danny, let me put that same sort of question to you regarding this collapsed Eiffel Tower project. Mm-hmm. What do critics say that this debacle tells us about Miami's inability to execute an urban planning vision?
Well, you know, listening to what Andres was just saying, the Live Local Act, in some way, it's the city at this point even has limited ability to plan its own future. I mean, the developers can kind of sidestep the city. So that it is what it is. The state of Florida did that. But with something like the Skyrise site, that was a city-owned lot of land. They did have a lot of say in it, and they would continue to have it. But part of what I've heard from critics is the city needs to get better at executing contracts. Like, they need strings attached to contracts. They need benchmarks. And, you know, if you don't meet this criteria, we take the land back or something. Because
so is the problem less of vision than just sort of more granular? You know, I mean,
on some level, yeah. You know, if the city is perceived as giving land away and not getting anything in return for it, and nothing has to happen there for a decade plus, you know, maybe the city needs to think about how they're doing these kind of contracts.
Yeah.
Reimagine it. Use their leverage.
That's an excellent and much more practical point. Yeah. Andres, in the minute we have left, I wanted also to ask you, you know, the point that Danny just brought up about preemption, et cetera. In the larger picture, does an urban planning vision even have a chance of surviving in Miami or any other city now if state measures like Live Local can simply preempt and undermine controlled development strategies like Wynwood's?
The answer is it makes it very, very difficult. And this is only one of many preemption laws on zoning. There's some environmental preemption has taken place. Mm-hmm. There's environmental preemption along the coast in flood zones that's affecting historic districts on Miami Beach. And, you know, developers run the state, and that's a fact. Here's an instance where City of Miami, although it was a private initiative to do the planning in Wynwood, again, tried to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And it's frustrated by Tallahassee, who used to be all about local control, and yet things have changed.
And Wynwood today, I mean, I know we're about to wrap up, but it does feel like almost like a Manhattan when you go there. It's like, oh, this actually feels like a city that's coming into itself. And then, you know.
And that was the goal. So just as this bears fruit, here come these potentially devastating changes. Whether they get built or not, we'll see.
Well, let's see.
But it would be a radical change.
Let's see if we can survive them. Andres Villucci is the Miami Herald's urban affairs reporter. Danny Rivero is an investigative reporter for WLRN. Many thanks to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Last week, federal authorities indicted Hialeah City Councilwoman Angelica Pacheco for healthcare fraud. She's accused of using her addiction treatment center and clinical laboratories to submit bogus bills to insurance companies totaling almost $20 million. She's also charged with defrauding the U.S. government during the COVID pandemic. Pacheco, a registered nurse, has pleaded not guilty. But this week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis suspended her from office. This would be shocking if it weren't so common. And unfortunately, a common thread is Hialeah. For decades, federal prosecutors have fingered South Florida as the nation's healthcare fraud capital, and year after year, case after case, Hialeah healthcare businesses keep popping up in these multi-million dollar indictments. In fact, as the Miami Herald reported, a doctor involved in the case of Councilwoman Pacheco's addiction treatment center is already serving prison time in a similar fraud case. Why is Hialeah a healthcare fraud mecca? And how can the city and other cities here known for this problem change that? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to discuss all this is WLRN's government and accountability reporter, Joshua Ceballos, who keeps an eye on Hialeah for us. We're also joined by Jay Weaver, federal courts and crimes reporter for our news partner, the Miami Herald, who has watched this phenomenon for years. Welcome, gentlemen.
Happy to be here.
Happy to be here, Tim.
Josh, tell us about Angelica Pacheco and this addiction treatment center of hers that's at the center of yet another South Florida health care fraud scandal.
Right. So Councilwoman Pacheco, she was recently elected in the most recent election cycle. She's run several times for the city council, and this was her first victory. Mm-hmm. And she's also a registered nurse, and she has, along with her husband, she operates these centers called Florida Life Recovery and Rehabilitation Inc. Mm-hmm. And that's that company, which stopped operating in 2022, is kind of at the center of this whole scandal.
Right, because the scandal we're talking about was between 2017
and 2020.
2020, right. Okay. So, right. These treatment centers then are no longer operating.
They stopped operating in 2022, but I think her husband still operates, or they still operate a business called Pacheco Medical. That's on 49th Street.
Uh-huh.
They still have a business ongoing.
Now, Jay Weaver, this wasn't explicit in the Pacheco indictment, but you uncovered something in it that's pretty striking, namely that a former doctor who worked at Pacheco's Florida Life Recovery and Rehabilitation Center back in those days is now in prison for similar health care fraud. Tell us about him and why his involvement makes this case significant.
Well, his name is Jose Santero. He's from Miami Lakes, which is not far from Hialeah. And he was the medical director for not only Pacheco's business with her husband during this period, 2017 to 2020. But he also worked for another addiction center, two of them in Broward County, and much larger, with a much larger billing activity.
Wow.
And these are centers that treat people with drug addiction, alcohol addiction, and there's a lot of competition among them. And the treatment centers in South Florida lure these patients to South Florida from out of state, from other parts of the state, because it's very lucrative billing activity.
Right, and they use like kickbacks, right, to the patients to lure them in. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. You can pay them any number of things. You can pay for their airline tickets. You can pay them cash.
Yeah.
And the key to it is the doctor. So back to Santero, he would not only admit these patients, but he would also write prescriptions for them for medication. And some of this medication, of course, is a substitute for their narcotic problem.
Right.
But at the same time, the allegation is that these treatment centers are basically just giving them substitute narcotics that just continue to keep them at the center so they can bill private insurers indefinitely.
Right.
So the allegation is the doctor is kind of a major cog in the wheel, and Santero mm-hmm. was not only for her,
right,
these two other treatment centers in Broward, and mm-hmm. that's how he got caught.
Right.
And her name came up a lot at his trial and at the trial of two others. So there was some
foreshadowing of this then, right?
Correct.
Yeah,
exactly.
Josh, what's the general reaction been in Hialeah to this rather stunning turn of events? How will the city, for example, replace the now suspended Pacheco on the city council? But more important, how do people, including Mayor Steve Bovo, fear that this affects Hialeah's image? I mean, Bovo says he wants to, quote, put this dark chapter for the city behind us. But this is what they say every time this happens, and it just keeps happening.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I mean, that's just Miami, that's South Florida.
Right.
But so the city has decided they're going to hold a special meeting in July where the mayor is very adamant about appointing a replacement. Okay. So they have a choice either to hold a special election or to appoint a replacement that will be in office until the next election cycle, which is in November of 2025. So more than a year from now,
okay,
that this appointed person would be in office if they're selected. I think there's a little bit of argument on the dais about who, whether there should be an appointment or an election. I know mm-hmm. Brian Calvo is a councilman. He's leaving office this year. He's always kind of battling against Bovo and the rest of the council. And interestingly enough, Pacheco usually sided with Calvo, and she was also the kind of counter Bovo person. And now she's out. So it looks like they're trying to appoint her replacement in July.
But do you get the sense that they worry that this sort of thing is staining Haile'ima's image?
I mean, I think that goes without saying. It's difficult for a city anytime this happens where someone on the dais is, you know, accused of criminal conduct and taken off. Mm-hmm. But I think, and this kind of goes into maybe something we'll talk about later when it comes to Haile'a, and this has come up at the council meetings where there's a perception that Haile'a is this Wild West, that it's not as civilized as the rest of the county, that anything goes. And I think this doesn't really help that image.
Jay, along those lines, can you briefly walk us through Haile'a's troubled history with healthcare fraud cases? I went back and looked up similar cases involving Haile'a. 2009, a pharmacy owner indicted for fraudulently billing Medicare to the tune of $20 million. 2012, a Haile'a medical clinic owner charged with defrauding Medicare of $7.2 million. 2014, another clinic operator there accused of $6.25 million worth of healthcare fraud, and they all resulted in convictions. I mean, this feels like Groundhog Day.
It is like Groundhog Day. And so a little history lesson. This really dates back to the late 1980s, 1990s, when Medicare became a very lucrative way to bill for healthcare with, you know, benefits for the elderly. Medicare pays fast. And so what you saw, and I know this is not going to sound very pleasant to your listeners, but you saw an influx of Cubans, immigrants, newly arrived, and they join these Medicare rackets, and they get involved with medical equipment rackets, physical therapy rackets, diabetes insulin shot rackets, HIV infusion rackets. And they are all over Miami-Dade. In fact, the situation became so bad in Haile'a, Westchester, Doral, even parts of Coral Gables, really all over the county. But where there are strong concentrations of Cuban operators of these Medicare clinics and facilities and Cuban doctors and other types of doctors, they bill millions and millions of dollars. And a lot of it's medically unnecessary or not provided as a service for all.
Right.
The prescription drug business got the pharmacies involved. And that's why you've seen such an uptick since the George W. Bush era, when Part D of Medicare became part of the Medicare system.
Right.
And it expanded dramatically.
As you mentioned to me earlier, Jay, what's relatively new is the addition of addiction treatment centers like Angelica Pacheco's in the mix of this fraud, right? What brought that about?
Well, what you started to see about 5 years ago is that the private insurers, Aetna, Blue Cross Blue Shield, United Healthcare, et cetera, started complaining to the U.S. Attorney's Office about all the fraud they were experiencing. And so rather than just deal with it as a civil matter, the U.S. Attorney's Office and federal prosecutors, FBI and HHS, you know, Health and Human Services, started focusing on the bilking of private insurers. And so this is one area of it. There are others. But the addiction part is regulated by the state Department of Children and Families. But it's also a ripe area for a lot of fraud. And again, Haile'a is at the forefront of it. But there are other population centers around the county where you see a concentration of Medicare fraud.
And I want to get to that with you in a little later. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with WLRN's Joshua Ceballos and the Miami Herald's Jay Weaver about the latest in a long line of healthcare fraud scandals centered in Haile'a and elsewhere in South Florida. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Josh, are we hearing anything, or are we likely to hear anything inside Haile'a city government now about how to confront this, whether it's through tougher oversight of healthcare businesses there or tighter regulations?
I think that's a reasonable expectation. I'm sure, you know, Mayor Bovo, I think, was not a huge fan of Pacheco, and he's likely to do a victory lap. And part of that victory lap might be, you know, cracking down on this kind of thing. But I also wanted to speak to something Jay was saying. I think on top of, you know, a lot of these Cuban immigrants coming in and you know, doing committing fraud, there's also a lot of Cuban immigrants in Hialeah that are, you know, older, that are, you know, not super familiar with the laws of this country or not super familiar with this country. And they're, I think, easy to be targeted by fraudsters, you know, mm-hmm. you know,
as, and that could be said of any immigrant,
immigrant community, yeah. but especially Hialeah's population kind of skews a little bit older. Mm-hmm. And these people, you know, they have pain, they have whatever, and they need to go in. They need to get medical help. They're not. I think they're not super familiar or knowledgeable if they're being used for fraud.
But another facet of this, though, and I know, you know, Miami New Times a decade ago did a real big investigation of this. Hialeah, for some reason, has such a high density mm-hmm. volume of clinics, pharmacies, mm-hmm. addiction treatment centers. Anybody know why that's the case?
So I've said this on the show before, and I'm happy to say it every time. So I grew up in Hialeah, and I still go there all the time. Yeah, you drive down the street, there's medical center, insurance, you know, small pharmacies. There's a lot of law firms like down Lejeune that deal with like medical issues. I think a part of that is because, you know, the population skews older. It skews immigrant. Uh-huh. It's, you know, Hialeah, as you've talked about before, is big for Obamacare, like some right? of the biggest signups for Obamacare.
Of any zip code in the United States. Yeah.
Right. And I think that it's just like this confluence of circumstances that right. makes it super easy to be at the forefront of this issue.
And Jay Weaver, we should point out that at least as far as the Cuban immigrant community is concerned, this issue was responsible for the elimination a few years ago of a longstanding immigration provision that benefited Cubans. And I'm talking about the so-called wet foot, dry foot policy, right?
Right. And so, you know, back then, as you know, at the tail end of the Obama administration, they finally rescinded the dry foot part of it, which allowed Cubans who arrive here by land to be adjusted for permanent lawful residency after a year and a day.
Yeah.
And so no other group got that privilege. So what did that do? You know, it started to have an impact on the Cuban American Medicare fraud rackets. Not entirely, because they're still moving apace, but you couldn't go back and forth so easily. In the old days, they would recruit the newcomers, pay them to be straw owners for clinics or businesses
right.
to insulate them from the actual owners so that they wouldn't get caught. And then after paying them off $30,000, $40,000, they'd send them back to Cuba. And I chronicled this extensively in a big series back in 2008. And not only did you have this phenomenon, but something else that was the other end of the spectrum, where there are a number of Cubans who were caught and fleeing the country and escaping, you know, the justice system. And there are hundreds of them. And they were going to Cuba. They were going to the Dominican Republic, Costa Rica, Mexico, Spain. A lot of them are still out there pending, you know. And I told you about one at one time that it was three brothers, the Benitez brothers. They absconded with $119 million. They went to the Dominican Republic. They literally bought hotels, motels, they created a Pirates of the Caribbean theme park over in the Bávaro
right.
area, you know, by Punta Cana. And uh-huh. eventually they made it over to Cuba. They're still in Cuba. And they're still wanted in Miami.
Right. So, Jay, in just the minute we have left here, to be fair, we should also point out, as you mentioned earlier in our conversation, that federal authorities see not just Hialeah, but other pockets of South Florida as hotbeds for the healthcare fraud plague, right?
Oh, yeah. No, there's no question about it. And it's in Broward. It's in Palm. And in fact, the problem became so viral that they have developed strike forces that have hit places in Tampa. They've hit places in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Houston, Texas, Detroit, Michigan, Brooklyn, New York, Los Angeles, anywhere there are large amounts of, you know, immigrant populations, they gravitate to these rackets. And I don't mean to malign newly arrived immigrants.
Sure.
I'm a big fan of newly arrived immigrants, but they tend to get pulled into
caught up in it, as Joshua was pointing out in the case of Hialeah, right. Yeah,
correct. And the FBI knows this, mm-hmm. and so do health and human services agents, and they've been dealing with it for years.
Right. Well, we'll see how we can keep this from prevent this from happening further in the future. Jay Weaver is the Miami Herald's federal courts and crimes reporter. Joshua Ceballos is WLRN's government accountability reporter. Many thanks to you both.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
After months and months of delays, a UN-backed and largely US-funded multinational security support mission finally began to arrive in Haiti this week. 200 Kenyan police officers landed in Port-au-Prince. They're a first wave of 1,000 Kenyan cops being brought in to assist Haiti's overwhelmed national police. They'll join the desperate effort to rein in the violent, powerful gangs that terrorize and control much of Haiti amid the collapse of the country's government. The question now, though, is what exactly will these multinational security support officers do in that effort? They'll be under the supervision of Haiti's national police, but does that mean they'll accompany Haiti's cops on raids and offensives? Or will they play a more background role, protecting, for example, the government infrastructure the gangs are so fond of destroying as Haiti tries to rebuild? Will they, in short, be the gunslinging cavalry Haitians have been waiting for, or more like security guards? What role do you think they should play? Do you have family in Haiti counting on this mission's success? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to help us answer those questions is the best Haiti reporter in the business, Jacqueline Charles, of our news partner, the Miami Herald. Jackie, many thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
What's your sense of just how relieved, if not excited, most Haitians were this week to finally see those Kenyan police officers land in Port-au-Prince?
Well, the word probably is relief, because Haitians were getting to the point where they thought this was not going to happen.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Haitians are torn. I mean, once again, here we have foreign boots on Haitian soil. You know, Haitians like to think of their country as being a sovereign nation and that they should be able to solve their own solutions. But this is the third foreign intervention in the last 30 years. And the fourth, if we go back to 1915, when the U.S. invaded
and occupied.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Jackie, who exactly are these particular Kenyan police personnel? They're not just Nairobi beat cops, right? They do have special training for the kind of anti-gang work that the support mission will obviously require, right?
Yes, these are specialized cops. They've been involved in the terrorist fight in Kenya. They've been very well trained. You know, everybody talks about the violence today in Haiti has required urban guerrilla warfare. Now, are they going to be able to deal with the situation in Port-au-Prince where you have this teeming capital of 4 million people and you've got these corridors sort of similar to what you have in Brazil? That's why Haitians at first were very excited about the idea of the Brazilians coming in, because they've done this, they've been there.
In the favelas
exactly.
of Rio and Sao Paulo and places like that, yeah.
But, you know, what the Haitian police has lacked, despite their great training, is that they've lacked the intelligence gathering, the equipment, the drones, high power, you know, rifles. I mean, the hope is that these Kenyans will impart onto the Haitian police their training and how do you go after terrorists, because some can regard that these gang members are essentially that.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. But are Haitians' expectations unrealistic for what these Kenyan cops will be doing in the country? I mean, I was struck by one of the anecdotes in your reporting this week. Haitian onlookers reacting to a national dance some of the Kenyan delegation performed at the Toussaint Louverture International Airport by chanting something like, "Stop dancing and start fighting," right? I mean, how much fighting can they expect from these guys? Just what exactly should we expect this multinational security support mission to do?
I have to tell you, that is the biggest challenge here. We've gone from where the debate was, should we get another foreign intervention in Haiti? We don't want it. We can take care of our own problems. To today, the expectations are so high. This, we have 200 Kenyans that are there. They're going to be part of a security mission, 2,500. But based on the numbers, what I've been doing, I don't see 2,500 security personnel in Haiti at any one time. The base where they currently are at, it mm-hmm. only has capacity for 450. Mm-hmm. Maybe they can eventually get another 400 at another location, but this is what we're talking about.
But regardless of the number, will they be as proactive in terms of, you know, confronting these gangs as many Haitians are expecting, or is there the chance that they'll play more of this background role that won't be so, you know, like the cavalry?
So you raise again another issue that, depending on who you ask in the U.S. government or who's involved in the planning, you get a different answer. This has been a source of debate.
Yeah.
You know, when the Kenyans first went to Port-au-Prince, I reported a story that says, hey, this is going to be a static force. Haitians were up in arms, even those who didn't support.
I remember
they're saying,
report,
if
yeah.
you're going to come, you're going to come to fight. But the problem is that what has happened in the last couple of months, as they've seen this violence has exploded, some of these officers who originally volunteered, not just in Kenya, but in Jamaica and elsewhere, saying, whoa, wait a minute, I did not volunteer for this level of violence. And so it's very unclear in terms of whether or not this is going to be a static force charged basically being security guards and protecting infrastructure, or are they going to go out on raids? I haven't been able to get a clear answer. We have yet to see the rules of engagement. We understand that that has finally been shared with the United Nations Security Council as required under the resolution that was voted 9 months ago. Mm-hmm. It will give us some idea. The former Haitian police chief, who was switched out last week,
right.
he said that, well, gradually the Kenyans will be involved. We know that the Kenyans asked for their own armored vehicles. They did not want to share armored vehicles with the Haitian patrols. And we also know that
the fact that the U.S. is providing a lot of those armored vehicles.
And everybody's committed that this is not going to be a situation where the foreign are going to come in and do the job for the Haitians.
Yeah.
So I suspect that this is still all being ironed out, but people want the Kenyans to get to work right away.
Right. And did Haiti's new interim prime minister, Gary Conille, seem to encourage those high expectations when he publicly called on the gangs to essentially just surrender and put down their high-powered guns once the Kenyan police had begun arriving this week?
Yes, and then he says, we're going to take the country back block by block. And then hours later, you know, Katsamaozo, just east of where the command center is, they set fire to the mayor's office in Quadabouquet.
Yeah.
So while we haven't seen the type of explosion we've seen in the last couple of months, every time you mention Kenya and Haiti, the reality is the gangs are still showing you that we have the ability to wreak havoc, and we're going to continue
well,
to
that,
do so.
That was my next question. I mean, how are the gangs responding themselves? I mean, you reported earlier this week on a ghastly gang attack on a town outside Port-au-Prince that seemed to indicate they don't seem all that intimidated by the arrival of the Kenyan police.
Yeah, so we're getting mixed bags. I mean, what's so eerie in all of this is the gangs in some sense have been calmer than they have been.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard Barbecue say, well, he wants a dialogue.
Barbecue being Jimmy Charizier,
the leader of the
Uber gang leader.
Yes.
Yeah.
We see also the U.S. Embassy, which last year canceled their July 4th celebration. They're now having it in an area where I'm like, wow, isn't it controlled by gangs? But so we still yet don't know, and we're waiting to see. I think the gangs are waiting for some sort of a signal. And just like the population, they're waiting to see what the Kenyans are going to do.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles about the long-awaited arrival of a multinational security support mission to confront Haiti's gang terror. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Now, Jackie, as you were mentioning earlier, the total number of Kenyan police officers is still expected to be about 1,000, but other nations are also expected to contribute officers to the mission, correct? To the tune of bringing the whole total up to about 2,500 personnel, more or less?
Yes, we've got Jamaica. They will be leading the Caribbean contingent, and there you're going to have Defense Force, which is basically military. You're having the Bahamas, that is also volunteer, Antigua. Mm-hmm. And we are going to see some from Benin. But honestly, this 2,500 is really an issue of the funding constraints. I mean, we've had a hard time raising the money to fund this mission.
Well, actually, I was going to come to that question, but let me ask it to you now. I mean, there's this question of U.S. funding, as I mentioned at the outset, for this multinational security support mission. Congress this year has been balking at releasing all of the hundreds of millions of dollars that are needed for this. Where do things stand now on that all-important front.
So the United States, so the Biden administration pledged $300 million, yeah. $200 million from the Department of Defense, which has been using that money to build the command center and provide some other assistance. Their money didn't really have any issues. But then there's $100 million, or now $109 million, that the State Department promised, and senior Republican leadership on Capitol Hill basically blocked that money. Well, last week, you know, Secretary of State Blinken basically used what's called the nuclear option. He overwrote their veto. They are not happy about it, but he did it, and that is what's allowed the Kenyans to deploy. Well, we are told that there's enough money there for this initial deployment, but in terms of the rest of the world, there's only $21 million in a trust fund, and the Kenyans have said, look, this is not going to cost us any money. If you want us to come, we need $200 million. They've right. estimated this is going to cost $600 million, and that $600 million is still not there.
So let's say, hypothetically, that all this funding does come through, that all 2,500 of these personnel do get on the ground in Haiti. A, is the size of this force going to be ample enough to take on these gangs? And B, will they have enough, will they be able to do this in time for the deadline that's been set for holding new elections in 2026?
And see what the success looks like, you know, in terms of restoring security. I mean, this is a debate. I mean, when you had the UN peacekeeping mission there that came in after 2004, you had about 6,000. It was police right. officers. It was also military. And the situation today is much more chaotic, much more dangerous. And these gangs have much more firepower. And yes, there's this deadline, because on top of the fact that these Kenyans are going to be working with the police, there are things that the Haitian, you know, government needs to do yeah. in a country that has been virtually destroyed. And that's the criticism, is that no one is seeing what the plan from the Haitian authorities are. They're talking, they're out there taking photos, but what exactly is the plan? Because everybody tells you in these missions, our job is not to go in and to make things perfect. It is to create the space so that the politicians can step in
to stabilize the country. Yes. But I also wanted to ask you, Jackie, along those lines, about a concern that one of the transitional presidential council members, and that transitional presidential council being the interim governing body in Haiti that was recently appointed, one of the members, Leslie Voltaire, brought up with me recently this concern that, let's say this mission does somehow vanquish Haiti's gangs. What do we do then with the possibly thousands of young Haitians who've been recruited by these gangs? How do we reintegrate them into society with opportunities, with some sort of future, so we don't simply repeat this cycle in Haiti?
And that is the plan that everybody's waiting from President Voltaire and his fellow members, as well as Gary Kuni, and as well as the international community. When UNICEF tells you that 30 to 50% of the gang members are youth or children, wow. you know, what do you do with them? How we're not even talking about the root causes that have led to these young people taking up arms. Yeah. And how do you replace that? When you're talking about the price of gangs, I mean, these guns are being sold for $15,000 a gang, gun you bought here for $500
here in Florida.
Yes,
yeah.
here in Florida, and illegally shipped to Haiti. So you have to be willing to offer them something, and that is a conversation that needs to happen. And we're not hearing that conversation, or we're not seeing a plan.
But finally, then, just an update today: the Biden administration extended temporary protected status for many Haitians here in the U.S. to protect them from being deported back to Haiti's crisis. Right?
Exactly. But they will continue to deport those who arrive any day after this 3rd of June or after today. So we're talking about 500,000 Haitians, including those who came through the parole program, will now have the benefit to stay here temporarily and work until things improve.
In the last 30 seconds we have left, are you confident, based on what you're seeing, that this multinational security mission could have success?
I plead the fifth.
Okay. As any good journalist probably would. Jacqueline Charles covers Haiti for the Miami Herald. Jackie, many thanks as always. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Finally on the roundup, the Miami Seaquarium has reached its final chapter this week, or has it? Miami-Dade County filed an eviction lawsuit Tuesday because the Seaquarium has failed to leave the Key Biscayne property it sits on. And as you'll recall, back in April, the county served the Marine Parks operator, the Dolphin Company, with an eviction notice. Usually, an eviction lawsuit means that's it, finito, you're gone, especially given the mounting evidence that the Seaquarium is a troubled shell of its former self, that its animals now live in squalid conditions, and that the public today views the attraction as a 20th century anachronism.
Even so, Dolphin Company officials said Wednesday they plan to keep fighting the eviction. Hilton Napoleon II is an attorney representing the Sequarium.
We've had several conversations with the county. I can tell you one thing. It's not about a mutual surrender of the lease. We are not going to surrender this lease. We haven't done anything wrong, and we're not going to let the county strong-arm us out of it.
Under the Miami-Dade lawsuit, the Sequarium has until Monday to vacate the premises. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.
WLRN.